This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han.
Good morning.
Good morning. And how was your weekend?
It was fabulous.
Really?
Yeah, I feel well rested, ready to take on the week ahead. I hope you feel the same as
I do indeed. I was in Penang, and I love going to Penang. It's Georgetown Festival.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so Georgetown Festival is... tons of really great acts, and I keep thinking to myself, do I have to keep going up every weekend? Because that's what I want to do. You know, a bit of a costly proposition if you live well, which means, you know, 4 weeks of living well, 6 weeks or whatever it is that the festival lasts, but lots of great stuff up there. Any news struck you over the weekend, you know, kind of made you kind of look up from whatever it is, the feast that you were munching on?
You mean that North Korean missile, maybe?
Yeah, there was the North Korean, absolutely, the North Korean missile, and also Donald Trump's response to it, which was to attack China, or criticize China, rather. And I thought the tweet that he put out was particularly interesting because he tied U.S. trade with China to the issue. Like, look, they've made billions over the years, and look how little they've done for us in the missile crisis. As if trade with China was somehow a part of the deal in dealing with geopolitical issues.
Yeah, at the same time, I think over the weekend as well, China had a demonstration of its military might.
Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and you got, you know, President Xi Jinping actually having to tell his army that the world is not safe. You know, what kind of ominous warning is that?
Yeah, well, the world is not safe with Donald Trump there in one of the hottest seats in town. Also, they haven't fought a war in a very long time. And so he's modernizing the army and also saying that they'll always have to be battle ready. And it's particularly difficult for armies that don't go into battle. Unlike the U.S., which has been fighting wars, many of which are because of its own making, you know, like Iraq and such. It's ominous, I think, in the sense that perhaps we all have to be cognizant of China's rise, not just in terms of business and economics, but really its military might is there too.
But also given the fact that North Korea is certainly ramping up its military ambitions, and with the heightened frequency of the number of missile attacks that have been missile launches that have taken place over the last few months, you know, it does not.
Yeah, this would be the 13th, but I think what North Korea has said is that this would not be a preemptive strike. This is about them warning those who would attack them. So it's a real defensive move. And we talked to several analysts over the last couple of months about this. Yeah, but it's about regime survival.
Yeah, but then when you compare that with statements that they're making, saying that, you know, these ICBMs can reach New York, you know, making statements like that, how is that preemptive or defensive in nature, though?
Yeah, because you're saying that if you attack us, we can attack you, right? Well, as opposed to saying we have ambitions to take over the world. So that's slightly different. In Australia, there was a thwarted terror attack, apparently aimed at bombing a plane. That also came very interesting. And over the weekend, a Pakistani court removed the president of the Islamic Republic. So that I thought was also quite fascinating, on allegations of corruption. That, of course, now moves to make his brother, Nawaz Sharif's brother, the next president.
And I believe they have got elections due by next year as well, right? So it looks like 2018 is certainly going to be a hotbed for elections, not just Pakistan, but Malaysia as well. And I think Italy and...
Well, you know, I mean...
countries, yeah.
A lot of speculation is, of course, that we're going to an election by October this year. But who knows? Who knows? What we do know is next up is Neil Young and Harvest Moon. BFM 89.9, Tan Chung Han and myself, Sharad Kutin, and the morning run continues. Coming up to 10 minutes past 6, and it's the 31st of August, 31st of July. The 31st of August would be a holiday. So I know I wouldn't be here if the 31st was of August was today.
And if you were, something was terribly wrong.
So now, speaking of being terribly wrong, there was a very clever person. I think a clever person, though the report in the Star suggests that this person calls this person a prankster. well, this is actually more like opinion piece, I guess, saying that this person had put a sticker on a pedestrian crossing at Light Street with its use of Manglish. And the sticker reads, and this is for the button that you would push in order to get the lights changing so you could cross on the pedestrian crossing at that point. Press once, can already.
Hmm.
Press once, can already.
In fact, when I saw that picture, I still think that phrase is two syllables too long. I think it can be shortened to press once, candy. Okay, well,
I have no idea. Your Manglish is of a special kind, maybe a millennial Manglish.
Yeah, I mean,
because
like,
can already what?
Yeah, instead of already, like, haven't you used that in WhatsApp already? You just do that apostrophe or something? Just D, yeah.
Maybe. I think, messaging systems have changed the English language in ways that we'll only know in a couple of generations. But the more importantly is, this act of introducing some humor into real life by putting a press was not appreciated by some, and the sticker was removed by the municipal council. But I wonder if it was, one level, kind of addressing the problem. And you know what the problem is, don't you, Han?
Well, I mean, I can see what the problem is, but then is it really a problem? Manglish?
No, Manglish, no. I don't mean that problem. I mean what the sticker was addressing, which is the fact that people keep pounding on these buttons, not recognizing the fact that machines of that sort don't move faster just because you pound on them.
Okay.
In fact, you're damaging public property, which I think is a much more serious issue than damaging the English language in this way.
I mean, I get that and I know that, but come on, I mean, help me out here. I would like to think that I'm not the only one in this room who has done that before, pressed the button multiple times.
No, I don't do that because
really?
I know how the machine works.
Well,
when you get into a lift, do you press buttons multiple times?
Okay, with a lift, no, but then with that one, because it's just cathartic though, I don't know.
Ah, that's right.
Yeah,
so people are taking out their personal angst on public property.
Right.
And damaging it in the process.
No, like, despite knowing full well that you just press once can already, but it's just, let me just tap it a couple more times.
Yeah, so why don't you get a little squeezy ball and work your angst out on that rather than try and...
I've got issues here, apparently, yeah.
Oh, so there's actually a Twitter or a WhatsApp machine? Oh, no. This is just a message from the producer who's paneling this. He sent me a message. I thought it was from one of our listeners, but it isn't. Okay, so we're going to ignore him because, who is he? Poor thing.
He's not important to the show.
But, of course, there have been other attempts to introduce humor and get people thinking about how they use public property. It was an artist that's thinking about it. Trying to kind of find her name. She wrote, I think, several things. It's spray painted on a road. This is not your grandfather's road.
Mm.
Now, which, of course, is an expression we use when we're irritated or annoyed with people who misuse the road or inconsiderate. They park badly, they obstruct traffic, and we say, this is not your grandfather's road, meaning you can't do with it what you will just because, it is in fact commonly used.
Mm.
She, strangely enough, got punished by the Singaporean government for her efforts. So,
go figure, right? But yeah, at the same time, I certainly appreciate the use of humor in highlighting the social ills or problems as we have described them to be. I think it's something that we hopefully can encourage without having to resort to fines or whatever the Singaporean government did to that poor, poor girl. Having maturity, having the kind of bandwidth to actually use these instances and see the funny side of it and hopefully alter human behavior along the way.
Yeah.
As in press once can.
I don't know if you were a true artist that you would imagine that your work could alter human behavior. That's the hubris of government, right? Governments think they can alter human behavior, and perhaps we even think that they ought to be in the business of altering human behavior. But
artists seek to compel people towards a certain either idea or perhaps
Which artists are you referring to?
Well, be it say,
I don't mean propaganda artists.
Ah, okay. Some of the other cartoonists that we had just mentioned.
Zuna? I think he wants people to... Well, he's an editorial cartoonist, maybe slightly different endeavor. But
change people. Well, I consider him an artist, maybe.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not? Yeah.
Well, coming up after these ads, New Order and True Faith, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. Tan Chung Han and myself, Sherwood Quitted. It's 22 minutes past six, and I think time to reflect on some of the news that happened over the weekend, including the fact that there's a building, a new building in town as it were, being built as it were. And it's a 77-story hotel project for the Four Seasons Place. And it's right next to the KLCC Park. And a horror of horrors is going to be obscuring for the view of the Twin Towers from certain angles. Now, some people might not think this is a big issue. Others do. In fact, I believe the Association of Hoteliers, or the Malaysian Association of Tour and Travel Agents, rather, have come out to say that they think this is a bad idea. It should never have been given approval because tourists love to take pictures of themselves with the Twin Towers. And any time you obscure that, you're going to have disappointed tourists.
Well, I mean, given that you have a 360 view of the Petronas Twin Towers, and I mean, I'm no mathematician here. I'm thinking this would obstruct maybe 10 degrees of that 360 degrees. No, so I'm thinking that there are still options aplenty for tourists to take pictures and those beloved selfies with the Petronas Twin Towers, right? So I'm not quite sure what the fuss may be all about.
It's about skylines. And so I'm just to put the side of the Malaysian Association of Tour and Travel Agents. They're saying that it is an iconic tourist attraction, anything that will obscure it. So what we also know is that this is just the first of several buildings that are going to be coming out around the KLCC that will obscure a view of it, also change the skyline, because one of the buildings that are coming up is actually going to be taller than the KLCC. There is something called there's a 335-meter high KL 1118 tower.
Yeah. 118, you mean?
Yeah, 118.
Yeah, the worrisome 118 tower, yeah. But isn't it sad? Look, I just had a meeting in right there in the KLCC on Friday evening, or Friday afternoon, Friday evening, and I was oblivious to the construction of this Four Seasons Plaza, the one that allegedly will be such an obstruction to the KLCC view. I think for many Malaysians, now I dare assume that we have grown so blasé over the number of high-rise buildings that are coming up over KL, that what's another one? You know? And like even this Warisan 118 Tower is like, oh yeah, here we go, another one, right?
It's
like,
yeah, so the towers, you might be right to the extent that people aren't excited about a new tower coming up. But this is really about the skyline. And the question is, should policymakers or people in charge of, you know, signing off on these authorizations to build buildings think much more about the kind of skyline that you want? Because the skyline for a city is very important. If you think of a city like New York or such, you know, skylines or the harbor front when you come into Hong Kong, right?
Yeah.
So these are important identity markers for a city, aren't they?
Sure. I mean, but you wouldn't think that this Four Seasons Place, KL, would be a hideous addition to the KL.
We don't know that, do we?
Well, I mean, I don't think so.
So it's not, at this point, no, it's not about the beauty of the building, but whether it'll obscure the view.
Yeah, but is a skyline like so, you know, sacred that we have to maintain it as it is? No, what's wrong with a couple more additions? I mean,
well, clearly this is a debate, and a debate in which the tour agents seem to have a strong opinion about. So, you know, well, tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. It's now time for Smashing Pumpkins and Rocket, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning. Han and myself, Sherrod, here to accompany you all the morning long, well, at least up to 10 o'clock in the morning. It's, of course, just 6:40 now on the 31st of July. Hmm. The end of the seventh month of the year. Isn't time passing?
Next thing we know, it'll be 2018. Man, I just... time... Like, isn't there a saying there about, you know, as you grow older, time just flies by faster as well? You would know this.
there probably is an idiomatic expression. Yeah. You're no spring chicken yourself, Mr. Tan Chung Han.
Yeah,
you know.
But
time,
relative...
your biological clock is ticking. And I know you've got no children. You have no issue yet.
But in
so,
relative
you know,
terms, it's all relative, my friend.
You know, the M word there is mortality. Mortality. Okay,
wow.
Now...
and morbid.
Morbid. No, not mortality. Motility.
Oh, motility. Oh,
yes.
Oh,
okay.
I misheard you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So we were talking earlier about Georgetown Festival. I was up in Penang over the weekend. Mm. And it is and has become, I think, the premier arts festival of the country. I don't believe Kuala Lumpur does anything remotely close to this in terms of scale and quality and visibility internationally.
Really?
So, yes. Can you think of a festival in Kuala Lumpur that has...
Like,
that?
I know a lot of BFMers, they do take part in that. I love a Kuala Lumpur festival.
Well, that's a festival of ideas.
Yeah, but there are many...
And the equivalent in Georgetown would be the Georgetown Literary Festival. Mm. So when we talk about performances, we talk about dance and theatre and the arts, arts and installation. Georgetown Festival is, I believe, remains the biggest.
Oh,
the
okay.
Kuala Lumpur Festival, which is, of course, run by Uma Paga and Ambike Parkin, who's a colleague of ours on the Evening Edition, who just walked by. I could just see him.
Because he lives here.
Well, he has extraordinary capacity to spend 20 hours in the office. He's one of the hardest working BFMers that I know. But, okay, the question really is, why go for these things? Yeah. You know, I mean, if you have to make a bit of an effort, if you live in Kuala Lumpur, to go for these things. But I do know that depending on the event, you might find half of KL in
right.
Penang for any event, especially some of the real big names that come through, you know, world-class dancers and dance troupes that come through really do attract KLites.
And I think Georgetown Festival comes hot on the heels of the Sarawak or the Rainforest Music Festival, I think. Well, my sister attended it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, the Rainforest Festival is the different one, and it's really big too, right? Mm. So the Sarawak Rainforest Festival.
So which one's bigger?
They're different because their approaches. The Georgetown, like I said, it's really about the performing arts. But you do have a jazz festival, I think, after the Georgetown Festival, which runs kind of like there's overlap.
Yeah.
And then there's the literary festival. I mean, Penang is really festival city in many ways. And the way that the Rainforest Festival, which is a festival of world music, is a kind of one-off for Kuching, isn't it?
Got it. Now, you were there for the Georgetown Festival. So what were your reasons for you being there?
Well, you know, I must say that I was there for a very personal reason. I actually am a subject in a photographic exhibition.
Jeez.
On people. Yeah, they're called. It's really about journalists and other chroniclers of Malaysian life or life in general. And a photographer, Essie Shaker, and journalist Chen Mei Yi put together this wonderful photographic exhibition. I was very honored to be part of it. But, you know, I also went to a design forum, a discussion with the highest quality of discussion about design, and they had people from Thailand, Singapore, and France there at this discussion. And also there was a beautiful exhibition put together by a Malaysian anthropologist from Sarawak. She's Bidayun. But the work that she does is in preserving Iban heritage. And it's called Pua Kumbu. And if you go to Penang, I would check it out because it also comes with this really cool app, which when you put over the surface of some of these beautiful textiles and fabrics that have been created traditionally, it actually shows up and tells you what was the inspiration for the original design. And they morph the original design, say, like a slow loris or a leopard, and that image warps and morphs into the textile design. So
right.
Some things that you might not even notice in a textile, and it's been inspiration.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful app.
Yeah, it's certainly intriguing, but I think also moving forward, it's very important that these organizers find a balance, right, between being able to preserve its identity and its niche versus trying to eschew the temptation of making it too mass too commercialized, right? I think trying to find that balance is important. I think we have seen that kind of discussion play out for like, you know, other music festivals here in KL, and then it gets, oh, it's too big, it's too mainstream now, we're not going to go to it anymore, kind of thing. So,
The issue of always reaching out, and when you use public monies for an arts event, you do want to get as many people involved as possible. I mean, I think that's the mandate of any government, right? But you don't have to drop quality just because you go mass. I don't think. Coming up, Cheap Trick, Surrender, after these messages, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Surrender by Cheap Trick. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. It's coming up to 7 o'clock, just 9 minutes away. But very quickly, recently the health minister revealed that the government is starting a proposal to allow only vaccinated children to be enrolled at kindergartens. This is in response to a question in Parliament on whether the government planned to penalise parents who refuse to vaccinate their children. BFM spoke to Puan Noor Sheila Abdullah, president of Persatuan Pengasuh Berdaftar Malaysia, or PPBM, which does advocacy on quality early education and childcare. About whether this practice is already in place.
Yeah, I think it has been practiced by most kindergarten who think about the welfare of the children and the needs of the children. They have been practicing, and I have already have parents who are refused. Normally some centres, like in my centre itself, those parents who refuse to do so due to their own reason, I will normally give them like 3 months. Please think about it. Go back to the doctor and ask the doctor, because they have missed like 6 or 7 immunization for the babies from their birth and things like that. So if they don't listen, they like very reluctant, I will give them a notice to say that, you know, for the other children benefit in health and all that, will give a notice for them to leave. And healthcare operators, they are required to have the card, the immunization card. When the authority comes in, they would also want to see, especially from the health department. Even by the welfare department, they will come and check the children's file, and they would like to see all this. It's a compulsory for us to keep in the file at the centre of preschool.
So we also asked Noshila if she considers this an infringement on the rights of parents and a denial of a child's right to education.
You see, if you look at Convention Rights of the Children, you are not taking care of the welfare, the health of the child itself. If you go to foreign country, there are some countries, they straight away take action against the parents. Our country, we are still very lenient and then try to be compromised and all that, you see. So I think the parents also should know that the child has the right for staying healthy for the welfare. It is a straightforward stated in our Child Act, in Child Act 2001. And I think the reason parents choose to have the vaccination for the children, sometimes they are being a bit conservative due to religion belief. And again, for me, I feel religion also asks us to stay healthy. Religion also teaches us to find ways and means to get cure.
Well, that was Noshila Abdullah, president of the Persatuan Pengasuh Berdaftar Malaysia, responding to the question about government proposal to actually deny kids entry into kindergartens if they had not been immunized.
And certainly a troubling movement here. And keep in mind, this is not...
Troubling move?
The anti-vaccination. This, and it's not something that's unique to just Malaysia. It's a global thing. Apparently, according to a professor at Baylor's University in the States, apparently in the state of Texas alone, there are some 45,000 students in the state of Texas who have actually received exemptions for their school vaccinations. So you've got even big names like Robert De Niro, who are apparently sympathizers with these,
anti-vaccination. Right, so, okay, the point is this. I mean, Robert De Niro, who probably could teach you a lot about acting. Perhaps
exactly.
Is not somebody you want to take medical advice from, yep. Right? And also, I think what needs to be said about the anti-vaxxers is not simply that they're making a personal choice. Their choice has a dramatic effect on the capacity of vaccines to work in a collective fashion, right?
Yeah, no, certainly. And with the kind of libertarian movements that we're seeing, especially in the States and obviously trickling through other parts of the world, at least via this anti-vaccination movement here, you know, where I think that discussion was quite timely, right? Where do you draw the line between preserving an individual's rights, you know, versus, say, the government's mandate to take care of the greater good? And
or even the fact that there's a trade-off between the child's right to education and the child's right to healthcare. And that seems... So it really is a quite a complex field. We'll be back after this. Now, Elvis Presley, Patch It Up. We're taking you all the way up to 7 o'clock for the Bulletin. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Tan Chung Han. And the Morning Run continues. It's coming up to 6 minutes past seven. And it's, of course, the 31st of July, 2017. I was going to say 1917, which is the year of the Russian Revolution. But... that is a bit of history that we do not have to get into at this point in time. I know I wasn't there at the birth of the Soviet Union. I must say, though, Victor Liu is correcting us, or he's weighed in on that whole anti-vaxxer thing. He says that he believes that Robert De Niro, the American film actor, isn't against vaccination, but he's asking if more research should be done on the spike in autism. Yeah. I don't know if we want to spend time talking about this, but there you have it.
Well, Vox.com labels De Niro as a sympathizer to the anti-vaxxers.
Okay, so Vox.com, second only to the Bible in terms of truth. that's something you might want to tweet out, Han. Okay. Now, speaking about truth, the tourism tax and the recent debacle over the waiver for medical doctors in government service are just two of the latest examples of policy U-turns. Now, the question, of course, is, are these flip-flops the result of being responsive to public feedback, or, in fact, a symptom of poor policy formulation that does not include sufficient stakeholder feedback? We spoke to Ira Azari, a researcher at the Social Policy Unit at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, for her thoughts.
I think we have to give credit to the government in some sense, because, let's face it, it's not every day that the government takes into account what people think about a certain policy, right? And for them to actually change the policy as a result of uproar by the public is something that we should be encouraged about. However, I would like to stress two things, actually. Firstly, the government might be a bit more receptive this time because general elections are not too far away. So they might, you know, want to look like they are listening to the people at this time. And I also think that because something like the tourism tax bill is not the most controversial, let's say, issue out there, so there might be less resistance from them to make the changes. For example, if it was a law maybe about divorce or child conversion or something to do with Islam, they might be a bit more resistant because it's more politically costly for them.
We also asked her about the question of public engagement and where it ought to be in formulating policy or laws.
At Ideas, we have always advocated for the government to have as many consultations as possible before a certain policy or a certain bill is drafted or put before parliament. So, for example, you know, if you are drafting a policy or a bill that is about tourism or is about taxes, about businesses, then, you know, it's your responsibility as the government to hold as many consultations with as many stakeholders as possible to get their input, to get their concerns about a certain issue. And we have always stressed that this should be done before a law is put into place. So what the government is doing now is they are reacting to the public's uproar, to the public's anger, dissatisfaction, only after the law has been passed. The whole point of a functioning democracy is for citizens to have a say in how they are governed and in the laws that they are governed with. So I would stress that while it is encouraging that they are doing these steps and it does look like citizens' voice is being heard, I would stress that it would be even better if consultations are done before. And don't get me wrong, the government does do some sort of consultation before laws are enacted or certain policies are put into place, but it's not enough. People from ideas from our organization have been to some of these consultations, and some of them look like they are done just for the sake of telling everyone, oh yeah, look, we have done this consultation. But there's no really much value added from this consultation to the policy.
We also finally asked her if she could share some of these experiences where ideas, her organization, has been involved in consultation.
Okay, so I personally have not been to a public consultation held for a bill, but some of my other colleagues have. Our CEO, Wan Sai Ful, has. And from his feedback that we get is that the questions or the issues that are raised at these consultations are, some of them are almost tailored to the answer that they want to get, if you see what I mean. Rather than a genuine consultation session where they will ask for your opinions or your inputs, it's more like a, like an interview session where questions are tailored to the outcome that you want to get, right? So it's not very comprehensive in that way. I mean, for me personally, I have been to not necessarily consultations about laws, but sessions where we sit down with government or government agencies. And yes, while we do get that room to voice our opinion, we are not very confident that they are really taken seriously and put into the document as a result of these consultations. And I think before the federal budget is tabled every year, there is also consultations with civil society organizations. But these are also quite superficial. There is not much time, actually, for you to really ask questions. Not much time is given. And as a result of that, the consultation becomes quite superficial, in my opinion.
That was Ira Azari. She's a researcher with the Social Policy Unit at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Ideas. Sorry, Affairs, rather. Our ideas.
Yeah, and I can only parrot what Ira says, because I do agree with most of what she said there. You know, because I think now, given the kind of U-turns that we have seen, you know, be it on the requirement for doctors in the in the government hospitals to speak Malay, or even the GST, the list of those items that are to be taken off that zero-rated list, you know, you have seen those U-turns. You know, I would like to think that the bias would be towards responding towards public feedback. I think we can all agree that there has been, there's plenty of room for improvement when it comes to the government engagement, the various stakeholders. But I think credit where credit is due, you know, there has been a tremendous amount of effort in trying to make sure that they do get those kind of opinions. I know that in my discussions with individuals who have been involved directly in those negotiations, be it the annual budget or even the TN50 program, you know, and whatnot, there has been a systematic approach to making sure that they get and hear these voices and
okay
opinions,
so you know. What I was just picking up some of the key things that Ira said was that they had to be genuine consultations, right? Not just ticking the box and saying, oh, we had a stakeholder meeting. What is a genuine consultation? One that's open rather than one that is scripted in order to produce an effect. And so I think that is something that we need to watch because as governments become more sophisticated, recognizing that people want, to give feedback, that they're maturing as a democracy, there is a tendency, I believe, and this is not a uniquely Malaysian problem, to pretend to be consulting, to give the form rather than the substance of a consultation, and to, and to script the whole process for public relations purposes. And so that is something that needs to we need to be cognizant of.
Sure, but also recognizing that there are so many competing voices in a society as diverse as Malaysia's, right? You know, like everything from, the importance of race or language, language, religion, politics, economics, whatnot. You've got so many polarizing forces. I mean, in any democracy, you've got so many polarizing forces, you know, even in, say, a society that is rather, you know, like that has one major overarching culture, like if I can say that. No, but here in Malaysia, you've got so many competing voices, so many competing interests.
I think that would be true. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't envy the policy holders.
Malaysia's not unique in that, right? So there are class issues.
But more so, right? More so, right?
More so than Indonesia? More so than the Philippines? I don't think so. Not even a small city-state like Singapore.
Oh, yeah,
there will be all kinds of competing interests, right?
Sure, yeah. But, you know, I guess considering how elevated the importance of, say, race is in the public discourse versus, say, a country like, you know, Australia, where it's, you know, still generally, you know... kind of monocultural, maybe, if I can use that.
You think Australia is monocultural?
Well, no,
I don't think Australian policymakers would even appreciate that, because they don't see themselves as monocultural.
Sure, I mean, again, broadly speaking here. But, you know, I think the discussion there is more like, say, immigrants versus non-immigrants and whatnot. But, okay, nevertheless, I think appreciating the tremendous diversity in voices and competing interests here, I don't envy policyholders and having to make those kind of decisions.
Absolutely. Oh, we'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.